daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And what a great day it is. It is 6 days from the Iowa caucuses where something will be sorted out. I mean, it always happens that way in Iowa. Sometimes the person who wins in Iowa does not win the election in general. In fact, in many cases, that's the case. Remember Rick Santorum tied Mitt Romney in Iowa in 2012? But what about the Sanders surge? The betting is that he stands a good chance of winning in Iowa. He basically tied Hillary last time. And maybe if he then sweeps New Hampshire, as he is expected to do, does well in Nevada, as he's expected to do, Bernie goes on to win, well, the whole enchilada, the nomination in Milwaukee. But David Frum, who is perhaps best known as a former aide and speechwriter to President George W. Bush in his White House, he is the author of many best-selling and important books, including A Prescription on How Republicans Can Win Again, which has never been more relevant. But David, you write a piece in Atlantic Magazine where you're a senior editor. Bernie can't win. What would block Bernie from actually winning the election?
Well, the headline was maybe a little stronger than the piece, because we live in a crazy planet where anything can happen. Dogs can play Jenga. Anything can happen. But it is exceedingly unlikely that Bernie Sanders can beat Donald Trump. And in the article, I give some reasons why. And maybe the most important is, although Sanders has been in politics for 40 years, although he's been in Congress for 32 years, he has never fought a competitive race. Grows up in Vermont politics, which played by very general rules. When he became a national figure, he essentially ran unopposed, first for House and then Senate. And then when it came time to fight Hillary Clinton, because she knew she was going to win and wanted to unify the party, she never used the dossier of negative material, but Trump will.
Okay, didn't Bernie run a couple of unsuccessful races for mayor of Burlington, and he ran for Congress on like the Vermont Independence Party, or I even forget which party. Well, he was part of a fringe party in Vermont, which is about as fringy you can be, right?
Well, this is one of the things that people forget. He was there for an independent party. In 1980, during the Iran hostage crisis, he joined the Socialist Workers' Party, which is a Trotskyist party. And the issue that seemed to have attracted him was he was afraid that the United States would use military action to free the Iranian hostages. Now, there's no record of Bernie Sanders himself saying anything about the hostages, but the leader of the party he joined called the hostages spies, denounced any attempt to rescue them, and there's video of all of that. As there's record of some of his strange sexual preoccupations, this is stuff Democrats had not used on him, because internal competition is usually not that rough.
Okay, so does Larry David know about the strange sexual preoccupations?
Larry David may have a few of his own.
But in terms of Bernie Sanders, you're talking about these pieces of porn that he published in an alternative newspaper in Burlington some years ago?
Yes. and again, it's his imagination. So I'm not saying, by the way, that any of this is fair, that these things are necessarily true. I wrote in The Atlantic for people, because we have a liberal readership, who are in the Democratic primary, who do not understand how vulnerable this candidate is. Everyone else has taken a punch. Hillary Clinton has taken a punch. Joe Biden taken a punch. They've been in real public life where people come, and you sort of know what you get. There are no surprises left. With Bernie Sanders, it's not a surprise exactly, but this stuff is knowable, but no one's ever used it in a weaponized way in a hard campaign.
And are you thinking that if it does end up being a hard campaign between Biden and Sanders, that the Biden team would not use some of the material?
They would not, because the Biden team would be pretty confident of victory. They may be wrong about that, but they'd be confident until the last minute. They would think they're going to win. And since they're going to win, they're going to need Bernie Sanders voters who are very devoted. They don't want to alienate them. So this stuff will be saved until the general. I think another thing needs to be said about the larger problem, and this is true just generally the Democrat candidates need to think about it. When you ask Americans, how do you feel about your personal finances or your health care? Americans are more content in 2020 with the status quo than they've been since the late 1990s. In every way we can measure, 2020 is not a change election. If literally anybody other than Donald Trump were president right now, they'd be cruising to easy re-election. The only reason this race is competitive is because of the unique and extreme obnoxiousness of President Trump to people who would otherwise vote for the incumbent party. So that your strategic plan, if you're the out party, has to be, most Americans don't want that much change in 2020, but a majority of them want this president out.
Which is, of course, and the basis on which you want to, quote, force this president out is not the basis of raising taxes across the board. I was looking at this Wall Street Journal compilation of the various tax plans by the various Democratic candidates. We're talking about a very, very substantial tax increase, certainly the most substantial tax increase anyone's opposed in my lifetime.
Right.
And that's not going to be popular.
I just don't think there's a lot of appetite for change anyway. I mean, they didn't like it. There was not much appetite for Republican change either. You know, they don't want the Americans Affordable Care Act repealed. Basically, it's like that. This is if you remember the middle 90s, people, you know, you people in Washington, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. Things are perfect. We have lots of problems as a country, but the things that people think the government is responsible for, by and large, they're reasonably satisfied. But they're very dissatisfied with the personality and temperament of this president. So the idea that the Sanders people have, which is America is ready for socialist revolution, could not be more wrong.
How would you describe? And again, you have this very solid point. You're actually citing the Joe Rogan endorsement of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And Joe Rogan being a tremendously successful podcaster who's known for his opposition to transgender rights. Now, Bernie's politically correct on transgender rights, right? So how does Joe Rogan turn to Bernie Sanders?
Well, one of the points I make in this article is there is something to learn from Bernie Sanders, and that is that Bernie Sanders is obviously very left-wing, but he's not very woke, but he's not interested in these kinds of issues. And I quote there from the debate in Los Angeles in December of last year when the question of transgender rights was asked in the debate. And Bernie Sanders nodded at the issue, said, yes, all for it, and then pivoted to talk about health care. Elizabeth Warren went into a long discussion of the importance and urgency of this issue.
Oh, wait, she said she was going to do a ceremony in the Rose Garden every year as a tribute to transgender women of color who were murdered.
Right. And so the secret of Bernie Sanders' appeal, and I get that he's obviously very successful within the Democratic primary, and Elizabeth Warren has done poorly, is he talks about practical concerns, not theoretical ones. He talks about material concerns, not cultural, and he speaks in universal terms, not particular. You ask him a question about whatever your group is, you know, indigenous people and environmental, and he will say a sentence, you know, the politically correct sentence, and then he'll pivot to, we're going to eat the rich and have health care for everybody. Now, that's not a majority formula, but it's better than what many of the other Democratic candidates do, which is they chop America into little groups, and they try to say something for each of those little groups.
Do you think it's beyond the realm of possibility that, let's say, Bernie Sanders, as he did last time, runs a strong campaign, wins a bunch of primaries and caucuses, but ends up falling short and not winning the nomination in Milwaukee? Does he just go gentle into that good night? Or do Bernie and some of his supporters decide, heck, we're going to run anyway?
Well, in the political science world, there's a huge argument about how many of the people who voted for Sanders in the Democratic contest in 2016 voted for Trump in the general. Some people put it as low as, you know, in the single digits, 8% or so. Other people think it might be as high as 15. But clearly there was some crossover. And there were Sanders voters who didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. And Sanders did not work that hard for Hillary Clinton. Like, a lot of this is one of the things that makes him kind of a different kind of person. Sanders, like a lot of people, are much more concerned with who controls the left than who controls the government.
Right. So I think that's correct. And wouldn't that argue, in other words, if you're concerned with who controls the left, then you would rather run as some kind of independent, making a strong showing, and re-electing President Trump than electing, say, a President Buttigieg or a President Biden, right?
Well, I don't think it's very likely that Bernie Sanders would run as a third-party candidate. He didn't do that in 2016 against Hillary Clinton, whom he loathed. I think he's less likely to do it against Joe Biden, whom he doesn't seem to loathe. But there is a good likelihood, if Biden is the nominee, that somebody like Tulsi Gabbard will run a Sanders-like campaign as a third-party candidate, with, by the way, a lot of help from Republicans.
Yeah, and that also helps assure Trump's victory, doesn't it?
It could help him a lot. You know, Ross Douthat, who writes the New York Times, had a tweet today in which he said that Bernie Sanders is a little bit like Ronald Reagan in 1980, that he's a high-risk candidate from the fringe of one of the two big parties, but, you know, why not gamble on him? Because if you win, you win big. Okay, but in 1980, we had 8% unemployment, 12% inflation, 16% 30-year money for mortgages, American hostages, the United States and Russia apparently heading toward war. And still, the candidate of the non-incumbent party, Ronald Reagan, only got 50.7% of the vote. But this is not a year for a high-risk candidate if you're the out party. This is a year to say, we're going to basically steady as she goes, only no more tweeting by that loudmouth in the White House.
Okay, who do you think among the current crop of Democrats would have the most viable challenge to President Trump?
I think it's just obviously Biden. For all Biden's many, you know, he's not as young as he used to be. none of us are, but he's really not as young as he used to be. there are a lot of problems there.
Yes.
And he does, and the Lord took the wrong son. But
obviously that's okay. Just so that people understand what we're talking about is Hunter Biden's older brother, Bo Biden, who was, by all accounts, he was a public servant. He was attorney general in the state of Delaware. He had served his country with distinction in Iraq. He was a good guy. He died of a brain tumor. And Hunter Biden, who has had nothing but problems in his life. That's safe to say, isn't it?
I think that's right. And it's a sad story, and I don't mean to make light of it.
No.
But it is. Hunter Biden has done a lot of reckless things that are not in any way Joe Biden's fault. I mean, Hunter Biden is a man of 50, but that will be used against Joe Biden, as we've seen it's already been used. So he's got many of these weaknesses, but he's a known quantity. He doesn't frighten anybody. And partly because he is so old, he's able to straddle that line between the woke and the non-woke part of the party. He's very liberal, but he's obviously very culturally old-fashioned.
And so do you think it's, in other words, the Iowa caucuses are 6 days away. What do you think happens in Iowa, New Hampshire, and taking us up to Super Tuesday?
Well, the key thing to remember from it, the asymmetry between the Democratic primaries, been through so many primaries, you know all of this. But the Democratic Party, the core of the Democratic Party primary vote are older black voters. But Iowa and New Hampshire are two of the whitest states in the union. And so you get a Democratic electorate that is not very like the Democratic electorate in the rest of the country. And so Bernie Sanders does much better with white Democrats than he does with black Democrats and Hispanic Democrats. And so he may do very well in Iowa, and he may do very well in New Hampshire.
He did against Hillary Clinton. He tied her in Iowa, and he wiped her out. Right, I think Bernie won in New Hampshire by about 20 points, right, over Hillary?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's next
door to Vermont.
Yeah, but this is what's fascinating to me, David, and I think we've spoken about this a little bit before, is there are so many people with just huge piles of money. I mean, there are polls now that show Tom Steyer running second to Biden in South Carolina and third in Nevada. And if some of these people with money, Tom Steyer, Mike Bloomberg, stay in, and Pete Buttigieg, I believe, has now raised over $100 million for his campaign, most of which he's banked up. If Pete Buttigieg decides to stay in, and you have Biden and Sanders and who knows about Elizabeth Warren, who also has some money. Do we have a real possibility of having the no nomination on the first ballot? Nobody wins a majority?
It's in the Democratic Party, it's much more theoretically possible because they have so much more proportional representation for delegates. So theoretically, it could happen.
And then what happens?
Well, but more realistically, if Biden doesn't knock out the other people, you've got a lot of people competing with Biden for Biden voters. You only have Elizabeth Warren competing with Sanders for Sanders voters, and she doesn't look like she's going to survive Iowa. So Sanders will have, it could be like 2016 on the Republican side, where the Sanders holds on to his minority within the party. Remember when Trump had a ceiling, and first it was 25%, and then it was 35%, but there are long periods where the majority of Republicans wanted somebody else other than Trump, but no one else could consolidate it, and Trump survived because he had the most intense followership. Something like that could happen with Bernie Sanders. Like Trump, he's kind of a niche candidate, but it's a strong niche, and so he could emerge as the strongest single force in a very divided party.
Wouldn't their big break be if you have Iowa, New Hampshire, and Elizabeth Warren doesn't show well strongly? Wouldn't the big hope be that she drops out and endorses Bernie? Is that even possible given the bad blood between the two of them?
I suspect if she drops out, she endorses Biden because, as you say, the bad blood. Also, Elizabeth
she endorses
Warren,
Biden, not Bernie she, Sanders.
Yeah, I think that's where she goes. Because remember, she's a much more normal kind of politician than Sanders. I mean, Elizabeth Warren has been in the Senate only since, what, 2006? No, sorry, 2010, something like that.
Yeah. But she beat Scott Brown.
She's accomplished much more in a decade than Bernie Sanders accomplished in 32 years. I mean, she is someone who knows how to write.
Yeah, so is everybody. I mean, Bernie Sanders has accomplished nothing in his 32 years in Congress, right?
Right. Other politicians don't respect them because they say you don't know the job. You're a player who will never pass the ball. And whatever the fans think about that, the other players do not like a player who never passes the ball.
Okay, but if you're a political advertising man, and I think both you and I have been involved in doing some political ads in the past, is there a better political ad than using the Hillary Clinton soundbite? Nobody likes him. He's accomplished nothing. Everybody hates him. I mean, if Bernie is the nominee, we're going to be hearing that again and again and again in Hillary's voice because it's on tape.
Yeah, and you're going to hear that. What you're also going to hear is that Sanders had to settle with and apologize to female staffers for a culture of sexual harassment in his 2016 campaign. That one of the ways where Sanders is quite Trumpy is it's a very male operation. And if you participate in social media debates, you know, it's just when you say something that the Biden people don't like or the Warren people don't like, it's just a very different experience from as I've seen over the past 2 days. That Sanders attracts a lot of male fans with high levels of aggression. And they take to Twitter and they act it out. And it's not a female friendly space that Sanders has built. It's not a female friendly campaign.
Speaking with David Frum, do you agree with the emerging conventional wisdom? And I think you do, because you were talking about the satisfaction in the country, yet a majority of people still think we're headed on the wrong track. I explain that always because people, when you're asked about your satisfaction, they think of themselves. When you ask what direction is the country going, you think of, all the news I see on TV. And they think about the country at large. Your approach?
I think you have to think very hard about the structure of these polling questions. And one of my favorite examples of how not to do polling is, remember the Merrick Garland holdup was in the news, and you would get these polls that said something like 55% of Americans thought that the Senate should vote on the Merrick Garland nomination. And I thought, here's how I would do that poll. Lately a man named Merrick Garland has been in the news for a reason. Can you tell me what the reason is?
And the answer is probably very few could. But people should read David Frum's piece, Bernie Can't Win. It's posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. When we come back, the deal of the century announced today. Will it hold up? We'll get to it on The Medved Show. On the Michael Medved Show, today, President Trump actually had a very successful seems to me, very successful and well-received, certainly, by the audience he'd assembled, but it was an audience conditioned to accept what the president was saying. He's been talking since he became president, really, about the deal of the century, about trying to make the ultimate deal, which is progress and negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And this would be helpful to the United States by helping to stabilize the Middle East in general. It would be a complete nightmare for Iran and the evil mullahs who run that nightmare regime if there was some kind of agreement or some kind of step forward by the Israelis and the Palestinians. And President Trump, actually, I think, handled this reasonably well today. And it's a promising event, even though Hamas, the terrorist organization that the U.S. doesn't recognize, that controls Gaza with its population of about 1.5 million, some people say 2 million Palestinians. Hamas controls Gaza, and they don't like what President Trump had to offer at all. But President Trump spoke about the contrast between his new plan for Middle East peace and all the plans that other presidents have tried in the past. Listen.
In the past, even the most well-intentioned plans were light on factual details and heavy on conceptual frameworks. By contrast, our plan is 80 pages and is the most detailed proposal ever put forward by far. As I have seen throughout my long career as a dealmaker, complex problems require nuanced, fact-based remedies. That is why our proposal provides precise technical solutions to make Israelis, Palestinians, and the region safer and much more prosperous. My vision presents a win-win opportunity for both sides, a realistic two-state solution that resolves the risk of Palestinian statehood to Israel's security.
Okay, again, that's not a passage that he was reading the teleprompter particularly well. What he was meaning there by resolves the risk of Palestinian statehood. In other words, a part of the reason that many Israelis, it's a minority, but it is a large minority in Israel, oppose the idea of ever recognizing a Palestinian state, is the very real risk is that Palestinian state will become like the Hamasistan in Gaza, where it will simply be used as a base for all kinds of rocket and mortar and worse attacks on Israel. And it won't be this prosperous new Arab state that was flourishing in the Middle East. It would be quite the opposite. It would be a base for terrorism. And so what he was talking about was there would be restrictions, and his plan also calls for a demilitarization of Gaza, which, of course, is not going to be accepted by Hamas and would require, I'm not sure what it would require, but it would have to require some kind of recognition on the part of the Palestinian Authority that if they ever did reunite with Gaza, which they would have to do, and there would be real pressure on them to do that if they had a Palestinian state, that demilitarization would have to be part of the equation. And that means no terror tunnels. It means no kites with firebombs on them. It means no mortar attacks. It means no rocket attacks. It means no rockets. And that, it seems to me, is a ways to go. But President Trump was optimistic, and Bibi Netanyahu can be very dour, was positively ebullient. He was extremely energized by the whole thing. President Trump viewed this step, which Israel strongly supports, as a movement toward peace. Listen.
Today, Israel has taken a giant step toward peace. Yesterday, Prime Minister Netanyahu informed me that he is willing to endorse the vision as the basis for direct negotiations. And I will say the general also endorsed, and very strongly, with the Palestinians, a historic breakthrough. And likewise, we have really a situation having to do with a race that is taking place right now. It will end, and we have the support, and it's very important to say this, of both parties and almost all people in Israel. They want peace, and they want peace badly. This is the first time Israel has authorized the release of a conceptual map illustrating the territorial compromises it's willing to make for the cause of peace, and they've gone a long way. This is an unprecedented and highly significant development. Mr. Prime Minister, thank you for having the courage to take this bold step forward.
Okay, just to try to explain what the president meant when he went off a teleprompter there. When he says the general also approves, he's talking about General Benny Gantz, who's the former chief of staff for the IDF, for the Israel Defense Forces, who is the candidate of the Blue and White Party, which actually the Blue and White Party got the most votes in the last round of elections. They're going to another round of elections. When President Trump was talking about in the middle of a race, he's talking about the fact that the Israeli elections are on March 6th. This is the third election within a year. The previous two ended up in virtual ties. And part of the idea here with this peace plan was that, and this was President Trump's doing, or the White House's doing, and I think they were right, that they would actually have Netanyahu come out at the same time as Benny Gantz, as his opponent, to make it clear that this was not just a political ploy to try to help Netanyahu. And they were supposed to be meeting with President Trump together, but Benny Gantz didn't like that because he thought that was demeaning if he was just sort of an add-on to the sitting prime minister. So he met separately, and he did express his support for the general outlines of the plan, which goes to the fact that the Blue and White is really a centrist party. President Trump is wrong when he says everyone in Israel will support this plan. I think there are people on the hard right who would be very opposed to this plan, and some people on the hard left who would be very opposed to this plan. The majority of Israelis probably are very enthused. He also made remarks about some of the conditions for Palestinian statehood. Listen.
We will also work to create a contiguous territory within the future Palestinian state for when the conditions for statehood are met, including the firm rejection of terrorism. Under this vision, Jerusalem will remain Israel's undivided, very important, undivided capital.
Okay, this is a little bit confusing because later on, he says East Jerusalem will be a capital for the Palestinian state. And so I'm not sure that the term undivided really reflects the details of the plan, which will come out in the next 24 hours. He then says this about the two-state solution, and we will get to that coming up. Look, in general, obviously this is very, very early in the process. What is important here is he spoke about trying to win support from Jordan. Of course, we will try to win support from our ally Egypt. And there has been increasing cooperation between Israel and Saudi Arabia on a number of fronts. So if some of those Arab states use their economic clout and help to back up the pledge of $50 billion in aid for Palestinian development that President Trump has made a centerpiece of his plan, is it unthinkable that there would be some support for this from the Palestinian Authority? We'll tell you about the response from Hamas coming up. On the Michael Medved Show, more on the deal of the century, which isn't really a deal yet because the most important, and I shouldn't say most important, but certainly one of the two important parties to this deal, which is the Palestinian Authority, has not by any means agreed to to the terms of the plan that President Trump has outlined today. And some of the details, there's an 80-page proposal with details about land and law that we'll be considering in more detail tomorrow after we've been able to digest it. This was just announced just moments before we went on the air today. But President Trump did make it clear that despite a bunch of rumors about, well, President Trump is going to abandon the two-state solution, abandon the idea of an independent Palestinian state as a step toward peace, as a step toward ending cycles of violence and actually making some economic progress, he unequivocally endorsed the two-state solution.
And crucially, the proposed transition to a two-state solution will present no incremental security risk to the state of Israel whatsoever. We will not allow a return to the days of bloodshed, bus bombings, nightclub attacks, and relentless terror. Won't be allowed. Peace requires compromise, but we will never ask Israel to compromise its security. Can't do that.
Okay, and that, of course, the crowd, which was strongly pro-Israeli and included a lot of Israel's diplomatic representatives and our ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, and others who were there, obviously applauding that idea. But he also made it clear, President Trump, that he was trying to offer something constructive to Palestinians. Listen.
This map will more than double the Palestinian territory and provide a Palestinian capital in eastern Jerusalem where America will proudly open an embassy. No Palestinians or Israelis will be uprooted from their homes. Israel will work closely with a wonderful person, a wonderful man, the King of Jordan, to ensure that the status quo of the Temple Mount is preserved and strong measures are taken to ensure that all Muslims who wish to visit peacefully and pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque will be able to do so. This is a major statement. This is of major importance. And at the same time, our vision will deliver a massive commercial investment of $50 billion into the new Palestinian state. You have many, many countries that want to partake in this. Over the next 10 years, if executed well, 1 million great new Palestinian jobs will be created. Their poverty rate will be cut in half, and their poverty rate is unacceptable now and only getting worse.
Okay. What President Trump is sketching out is a different view of the future. I do think that there is an obvious conflict between different things that he said in his declaration here. Jerusalem would not be the undivided capital of Jerusalem if there is a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem. And this is one of those things that Israelis are very skeptical about. And I don't know the extent to which Prime Minister Netanyahu has signed on for this. He is in the midst of an election campaign, and this probably will help him in the election campaign. He spoke very forcefully, and he, in fact, compared this day optimistically to Israel's Declaration of Independence in May of 1948. Listen.
To all of you and to the many other distinguished guests who are here today, this is a historic day, and it recalls another historic day. We remember May 14th, 1948, because on that day, President Truman became the first world leader to recognize the State of Israel after our first Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion, declared our independence. That day chartered a brilliant future. Mr. President, I believe that down the decades, and perhaps down the centuries, we will also remember January 28th, 2020, because on this day, you became the first world leader to recognize Israel's sovereignty over areas in Judea and Samaria that are vital to our security and central to our heritage.
That's Prime Minister Netanyahu. He also gave a resounding vote of confidence in President Trump as a very strong friend of Israel in the White House. Listen.
I've agreed to negotiate peace with the Palestinians on the basis of your peace plan. It's a great plan for Israel. It's a great plan for peace. Frankly, Mr. President, given all that you have already done for Israel, I'm not surprised. You have been the greatest friend that Israel has ever had in the White House. Frankly, though we've had some great, outstanding friends in these halls, it's not even close.
Trump was smiling broadly. Of course, he likes that reaction. The Palestinian ambassador to the United Kingdom, whose name is Hassam Zumlot, was not as enthusiastic as Prime Minister Netanyahu. He spoke on BBC Radio 4.
This is not a peace process. You call it diktats, you call it submission, call it whatever. And I would prefer President Trump to come out and say, I call on the people of Palestine to succumb, I call on them to surrender and just to give up their rights.
Isn't the reality that they're not much interested, forgive me, in what you think or indeed what President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority thinks? They're obsessed with Hamas, controlling Gaza, who are very clear that Iran is their principal ally there. They, I mean Trump and Netanyahu, believe that Iran is the greatest threat on the planet, that Hamas is allied to them, and for the moment they're perfectly happy to ignore you altogether.
Well, if ignoring means that they will not dismantle international order, if ignoring means that we can save whatever we have in terms of the rules-based multilateralism, let them ignore us, my friend. Because it isn't about Palestine now. It is about the premise and the heart of international order that was established by Europe, by the United Kingdom, your legal brains. It's about the horrors of the Second World War. Only yesterday, we remembered the never again of what happened in the Second World War. And therefore, this is a moment for us.
Okay, I'm not sure what he's trying to say about the international order. And when President Trump was talking about increasing Palestinian territory, right now the West Bank, which, by the way, has never been formally recognized as Palestinian territory since the initial Arab rejection of the offer of a Palestinian state in 1947, with the original partition that was voted by the United Nations then. 1947, that's a long time ago. That's, 73 years ago. And the idea that the Palestinian Authority is reacting this way, not that surprising. It's more positive than Hamas. Palestinian terror group Hamas today dismissed President Trump's long-awaited Middle East peace plan as conspiracies and warned all options are open. There are photographs of Hamas demonstrators throughout Gaza. They have nothing better to do, burning photographs of President Trump and photographs of Bibi Netanyahu, of course. It says, across the Gaza Strip, Palestinians took to the streets to protest the plan. Another Hamas official, Sami Abu Zuri, called Trump's statements as he unveiled the plan aggressive and warned it would spark a lot of anger. Perhaps the most auspicious beginning in winning a reception of a peace plan, but maybe it is just a beginning. We can only hope so. We'll talk about the future of the bomb. Are we really directly threatened in this greatest nation on God's green earth?